This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Greetings, everyone. This is Brian Reisman, host of Side Jams, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Please subscribe and follow the show on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and also know that it is now available as a video podcast on YouTube. Hey, everybody. It's Brian Reisman, host of Side Jams, the show where we talk to musicians about their outside passions and their hobbies. And today we have Daniel Estrin, the frontman and keytar star for Voyager.
Such a pleasure to be here. I don't know which is my side jam, my music or my day job. I don't know. It depends.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. This you're an immigration attorney by day.
Yep.
Rocker by night. So it's actually your side jam is your music. But I still wanted to have you on because it's just so interesting. You even said, because you know, Voyager represented Australia in Eurovision, and you're probably the first and only immigration attorney to be on that stage.
If someone can challenge me and show me another one, then I'll be very impressed. I'm not sure if I'm the first attorney, but I'm definitely the first immigration, the first administrative lawyer anyway. So yeah, I'll take that one.
The new album, obviously Fearless in Love, is very cool. Obviously it's the big single, Promise, but you also have it's Daydream and Submarine. There's some interesting songs and cool videos.
Yes.
You guys do a lot of videos, actually.
We do, and sometimes you're going to think, well, you know, is it worth doing a video? Because the video, you know, it's a money burner. Someone said it's like the most expensive Facebook post you can make. And it's true, but there's something fun about doing it. There's something fun about reinventing yourself and showing yourself in a different light. So we always have a lot of fun, and we work with some great videographers and some great directors. So if this is you telling us we should make less videos, then it'll be a financially more responsible decision for sure.
Well, I like that. I'm always surprised because what's interesting is, you know, the band goes hand in hand with your law career. I mean, you started the band in 99. You've been there the whole time. I think Simone came in 2006. So she is the second longest running member of the band. And the line has been solidified since 2011. But I mean, you spent, it looks like a dozen years, I mean, in university, because you started, according to your law page, the band was formed at University of Western Australia. So you got a Bachelor of Arts 2001, a Bachelor of Law in 2003. And then you went to Australian National University to get your graduate diploma in legal practice in 2006. And 4 years later, you had a graduate certificate specifically in migration law. So you've really, like, the two have gone hand in hand the entire time.
They have. I've always had very understanding managers and supervisors who were always very keen to give me the leave and the holidays that I needed to do the touring, because I was obviously serious about it. So, you know, once it becomes more than just a hobby and becomes a serious hobby, you kind of go, okay, how do I start balancing this? And the balancing exercise can become quite difficult at times. So I made sure that, maybe this was strategic, that wherever I worked, I would try to get the manager or the supervisor, who would be the person approving my leave, really into the band. It's like, oh, check this out. Oh, that's really cool. Yes, it is. Can I have 4 weeks off to tour Europe, please? Sure, no worries. So it's funny because on paper, like if you look at my resume, my CV, it looks like a very responsible legal career. But you know, this sort of the Jekyll and Hyde thing where you can make two things work and you can make two serious careers work concurrently. Not everyone can do that. Not everyone wants to do that. It is difficult, but there are 24 hours in the day, I always say, so you can make it work.
Now, obviously you were a kid in Germany. How old were you when your family moved to Australia?
I was 11. So, I'd spent a significant part of my life in Germany and didn't speak any English when I came to Australia, and I had the full migrant experience. It was it was full on. And I think heavy music at some point kind of helped me through those difficult teenage years. And yeah, I'm eternally grateful to not only the sort of the rock and the metal community, but just bands like Typo Negative for just bringing me through those difficult years, and being my musical accompaniment to them.
So obviously that seems that I imagine that part of your passion here for migration law is the fact that you were an immigrant and you came to Germany. And were there any experiences in your childhood that might have influenced your decision to go into that area of law?
It's funny. I thought it was my migration experience that made me want to become a migration lawyer, but I don't think it was because I didn't really have the same migration experience as a lot of adults have. I was kind of dragged along as a child, and it was probably easier for me than most, which is not saying much because it was still quite hard. I think my passion for immigration law stems from just a love for weird bureaucracy and red tape and passports and countries and obscure, breakaway regions. I don't know. I've always liked that obscurity. I've always liked that everything is made up, and immigration law, particularly, and borders are completely made up, more made up than law itself. And that kind of fascinates me. So maybe I think it's more that than my own migration experience, to be honest.
Does it help you though identify with people like your clients that you're working with, like the some of the emotions they're going through, the concerns they have? Are you able to identify, at least to relate to some of it?
Yeah, and I think actually music helps a lot, to be honest. I think being in tune, being a musician helps you develop sort of an EQ and I think a sensitivity that is more a human connection, and that in itself helps me with the law. So it's certainly that experience of being scared of the new and coming to a new place and having to settle there, but also just that EQ that you really need in something like law, which is a service-based industry, and particularly with immigration law, because you're dealing with people who have uprooted their entire lives to be in Australia, who are struggling to stay here, and it's not all bad. Some of them are just purely formalities, but behind every formality is a person, and when you can connect with them on that emotional level, it's really nice, and I thank music for that, I think.
Well, I mean, Promise, I know the first single off the new album kind of deals with kind of coping with the chaos in the world, and it has a lot of the positivity that I think is in a lot of the music. I mean, that's a term that gets tossed around way too much these days. But like in your case, like you guys have a, it's metal. I mean, it's got the 80s synth pop and 80s metal with the prog and some djent, as some people have said, and some
Yes.
little trance techno that you toss in there. But like overall, even though there's aggressive moments, it is still very upbeat music. It feels like there's a lot of passion behind it, and it's different. I mean, I love metal for the exorcism that it brings, the dark side, but you guys sort of have a balance, a larger balance, I think, between the two.
For sure, yeah. I mean, we certainly have a dark side as well, but I think particularly with a lot of our music, it's about the melody, it's about the catchy choruses, and it's a sort of what I call uplifting melancholy. Because I like wallowing in melancholy, that's a very metal thing to do, but I also like being uplifted at the end of it. So Promise, particularly for Eurovision, which should be a positive event in a very unstable world at times, we wanted to make sure that there is that mystery in the beginning, there is that melancholy, then you do get crushed halfway through by this sort of breakdown, but you do get uplifted towards the end. And I think that's the thing that I think a lot of metal music is missing, is that balance between the melancholy and the darkness, and also the uplifting nature of metal. Because at the end of the day, like, metal is entertainment. A lot of it's a huge spectacle. There's big guitars, big notes, big vocals. So it is a spectacle, and why not translate that to the Eurovision stage?
I'm actually curious, because immigration is obviously something around the world that is becoming a hot button topic.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if you see very, if you, there are a lot of differences in what you see between the American, German, and Australian views of borders in migration, or is it all relatively similar?
I think it's vastly different, and mainly because Australia has just that wonderful geographical boundary, which you could almost say is a natural border. We're an island, and whenever you're an island, you try to protect that island. And so we have a very, quite a harsh, quite a difficult immigration policy. I think it's the game Diplomacy, where if you get Australia, you just, you know, you're probably going to win because of its geographical location. So the juxtaposition to Germany, which is, you know, welcomed a lot of people from who were fleeing persecution or fleeing war and unrest in the last decade or so. I mean, I think Germany welcomed something like 2 million people, whereas, you know, Australia's refugee program might be, you know, less than 20,000. So there's a
certain amount. Annually or?
Sorry, annually, yeah. So it's okay. It's a different attitude, I think, which is funny because Germany's not traditionally an immigration country and Australia is traditionally an immigration country. So this kind of protectionism does baffle me at times, and the fact that Germany has been very welcoming and less stringent is quite strange. But what I do see around the world is that, you know, there's a lot of push for skilled migrants now, you know, and Australia's now competing with places like the US, Canada, Germany for their skilled migrant places, whereas, you know, in the past we haven't had to try that hard. Now I think, you know, there's that competition and we need to try that a little bit harder. So there's this push to welcome people, but they might say, well, it's really complicated and the system's full of red tape. Now I'll just move to Canada instead. So there's a really interesting kind of skilled migration piece to immigration law as well, which fascinates me.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, here it's a very big hot button topic, but then again, every other topic in this country, my country, is hot button.
You
topic
guys are just hot about everything. Like, there's everything's polarized, everything's so full on, and that's what I love about, you know, North America. There's so many things to love and so many things to hate, and it's just great.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, no, immigration is something interesting. My mother was a Cuban refugee in the early 60s.
Okay.
My grandfather was Syrian. He went to Cuba. He was going to go to the States, but he ended up in Cuba. There was an Arab population. He liked it there. He met my grandmother, who's Spanish and French. So I have my Spanish, I guess, great-grandfather would have been from Asturias in the north. You know, my dad's from the Midwest, so he's in Illinois. So it's like he's English, Scottish, Irish, German. My mom's side is a little different. It's a bigger mixture. And you know, and they
That's
had to leave
so
Cuba
cool.
because Castro took all their money, and then their parents spent 6 months in Mexico, get over here, and then he starts life all over again. So I sit there going, yeah, my life's not so difficult.
It's, you know what? Yeah. And these are the wonderful stories that make our countries what they are today. And, you know, America without immigration would, I mean, where would you be? It would be a vastly duller place. And, you know, if all the undocumented, you know, immigrants left the country, the country would probably collapse. So it's funny to have such a harsh migration system for countries that are so heavily reliant on migration. And I think people see migration, they think migration, they go, oh, you need to work for refugees. It was like, no, yes, we do. But at the same time, it's like an economic portfolio as well. My light's just gone off. It's an economic portfolio because nation building is heavily based on immigration, and people have never really seen immigration as an economic portfolio. Every migrant that comes to the country contributes to the gross domestic product. Like, everyone is helping, everyone's doing their bit. So it's good to have that paradigm shift sometimes and go, oh, it's not just refugee law, it's actually an economic thing that we need. Without it, we would be screwed, both of our countries.
What are actually the main reasons people come to Australia, and where are the main places that they come from?
Our top countries are at the moment the United Kingdom, India, China, and New Zealand. And the reasons that people come are generally quality of life. Quality of life and security, stability, and also quite a high standard of living, I would say. You know, Australia, yes, it's expensive, inflation, yada yada, but you know, the degree of stability, the general lack of corruption, the transparency of government, which, yes, it can be slow, especially in immigration. But those are the reasons that I think drive a lot of people. you know, I often speak to clients who are like, you know, I could be making four times as much money in Oman, you know, working in oil and gas, but I don't want to. I want to live in a nice city like Sydney or Melbourne or Perth and you know, have that freedom, breathe clean air. Air is a big one. You know, you don't think about that, but air is huge. Yeah. You know, people love to breathe. If you're living in Beijing and there's smog every time, or you're in Delhi and it's just this cloud of smog, you're going to come to Perth or you're going to come to Brisbane in Australia and go, wow, this is amazing. And it's not that unaffordable, you know. I mean, you can still buy, in certainly not in the big cities like, you know, Sydney and Melbourne or Perth, but you know, cities like Adelaide and some of the smaller towns, you can buy houses, probably not too dissimilar to the United States, for a reasonable amount of money. The other thing is, you know, people still do have that the similar sort of idea about the Australian dream, similar to the American dream. You know, you can make it. You can make something of yourself here, and it's a wonderful country. And it's actually quite a small country. Our population is 24 million, so it's a country that has incredible resources, which we just tend to dig out of the ground and export without doing too much to it. But so it's a country with enormous potential, and it's always been called the lucky country for that reason.
Now that you've been on Eurovision, I mean, the band's been around for 24 years, but now that you've been on Eurovision, how has that affected your job and people's perception of you? Because now you're not just the immigration attorney, you're like this, you're confused by someone as a rock star who might not have known that before about you.
Yeah, look, I think I tried to keep it a secret for some time, but then when we got into the finals for the Eurovision, the Australian component, I was like, we just have to lay all the cards on the table. So, you know, the hair came down, and you know, even LinkedIn was full of Voyager stuff. So people are like, whoa, what's going on here? And I think what was incredible is that the legal community in Australia really embraced it. Whether it was judges, whether it was you know, barristers, whether it was clients, they embraced it because they could really see that you can be a professional and still have a very, very serious hobby on the side, and they sort of appreciate that creativity. And it also ties in with very much within the narrative that is very strong in the legal profession, which is work-life balance. What people don't realize is that being in a band is also work and a lot of stress. But, you know, people don't know that, and they go, oh, this is just this cool thing that you do on the side. It must be your relaxing outlet. Yes, it is. And that really ties in with a lot of the narrative that the legal community is going through at the moment. Whether that's the reality or not, I don't know, because law is still a very demanding profession, as you would know in the United States. But I was very surprised to see how much support there was actually from the legal community. I think in a lot of other countries that would not have been possible, that have far more conservative legal professions. I remember doing an interview with the Dutch Society of Jurists, and the interviewer was like, well, how do people take you seriously? You know, in the Netherlands, this would just not be possible. You know, so you've got this. You can see that people are progressive in their thinking, even though that we, you know, the law is considered to be a conservative profession. And I've been told before, you know, I got offered jobs, and people's like, well, you're gonna have to cut your hair because this is a conservative profession. And I said, no, thank you. The wonderful thing about it is, if I look around now, it's not as conservative as people would think. I think a lot of lawyers are very progressive, and I think we just get a bad rap. So anything I can do to my legal fraternity to make sure that I'm making lawyers slightly more cool, slightly more accessible, and slightly more friendly, I'll be happy to be of service.
Are there any lawyers and judges that you know that are metalheads?
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. There's quite a few. In fact, there's quite a few lawyers and in fact judges who are musicians, not necessarily metalheads, but there's not such a huge disparity between the two, because when you're very left brain focused, you sometimes need to activate the right brain, which is the music side. And a lot of the creativity that you develop there, you actually can apply to the law and think a lot more laterally. So law and music kind of go hand in hand in some ways. That might not seem natural, but certainly I think more so than mathematics and music, which I'm always told if you're good at music, you're good at maths. I am a perfect example of why that is not correct. So perfectly aligned, I think, law and music, maths and music, not so much.
What have been some of the more unusual immigration cases that you've taken on?
Look, it ranges from someone coming into your office saying, I haven't had a visa for 38 years, can you help me? you know, been living in the community and they've just finally decided, hey, this is too much. I can't handle this anymore. I need to come clean. I need to sort out. I need to regularize my status. So, and you work a lot on that. There's a lot of...
But they're living in the country for 38 years without a visa.
Yeah,
you can just fly, they just fly under the radar.
Yeah, yeah. The 80s was an amazing time. You know, there was a lot of paper. There was not a lot of systems. It was great. You could do a lot of things. Some of these people have been... You know, they got social security payments, they were voting, and you're like, how did you get yourself in this situation? There's plenty of those in the States as well, no doubt. And those are really interesting parts because you can really help a person kind of get out of the darkness and out of the fear into some sort of stability. We see a lot of sort of corporate migration as well, you know, trying to get people, you know, I need this person on an oil rig, you know, next week, that type of close sort of global mobility. Which is also exciting because you're dealing with very, very quick, very fast turnaround times. But some of the more, I guess, personal ones are, you know, people who come to Australia with and have children with health problems, for instance, or they get sick, they don't meet their health criteria. There's appeals. Then you finally, you know, you win something, you go back to a tribunal, and the tribunal says no again for a different reason. It's this ping pong. You know, there's families who've been here for 12, 13 years. And when you're fighting the good fight there, and you finally get to make that call to say, hey, you guys are permanent residents, and your kid with a significant disability who's been fighting for such a long time and is very much part of the community gets to stay. Those are the really wonderful moments that make it all worthwhile. And you know, it's such a nice area of law when you do get to make those phone calls, when you do get to really, really change a person's life. And you know, I had a client come to my office the other day and he said, I think about you every day. And I thought, that sounds creepy, but I get why. You know, he's grateful. Yeah. I got him out of detention. He was in immigration detention 10 years ago. I got him out of detention. He literally had every single thing go wrong with his visa that could possibly go wrong, which is now a thing that I tell my junior lawyers about. Like, this is a perfect example of how things can just go horribly wrong. And now he's a citizen. He's got his own IT company. You know, he's doing well. He said, I bought a Mercedes the other day, and I was just thought of you because I wouldn't be here without you. And that is an awesome thing to hear, and that makes it all worthwhile.
Have there been any cases that you wanted to win, but it just didn't work out? Like, it was like a family that came over, or was there?
Yeah, there's some that you want to win, and you kind of want to push it further because you've got the fight in you, and it's like, I don't care, I'll do it for free, whatever, you know, I'll do it pro bono, it doesn't matter, because I believe in this. You've got to believe in the case, you've got to like your client, or you've got to be paid very well for it. If none of those are ticked, then you shouldn't take the case on. But, you know, there's those cases where the client just goes, you know what, no, I've had enough, I've been through the system, and I'm just going to go home, I'm going to give up. And you know that there is a small chance that, you know, if you pushed it and you kept going, you know, you went to that next appeal, they could possibly win. And you kind of defeat it because you want them to continue. But at the same time, you have to realize that, you know, their life is not your game. And if they make that call, then, well, that's their call to make. So there certainly have been a few of those. But generally, we do all right with our cases. Not 100%. Nobody's got 100% win rate, but we do all right.
Yeah, I mean, you co-founded this. So it's Estrin Saul.
That's right.
And when year was the migration specialist? What year did you found your law firm?
Almost 10 years ago, so 2014.
Wow. How many cases do you think you've taken on in that time?
We just reached 15,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how do you sleep between being an attorney and being in a band? Do you get a lot of time off? I mean, I know we're doing this interview. It's like 11 a.m. here. It's 11 p.m. where you are in Perth.
No. I like to sleep. And I did naps. Naps are a big thing for me. Naps are invigorating.
I get it. Yep.
You know what I mean? You get it. We've got a nap room at work. And, you know, sometimes I just go in there and just have 15 minutes. And then I feel amazing for the next 4 hours. So that's why I like touring so much on a tour bus. Because you put your little bunk bed and you just go on there and have a nap and you feel reinvigorated. Look, there is a lot. We started the firm in 2014. It was two guys with a couple of maxed out credit cards. just wanted to get out of the big rat race. We were working for a big firm, which is actually it was a New York based firm, a global mobility firm. And you know, we got out. We decided let's just do our own thing. We don't really need to do that many cases. We don't need much money, and we've grown to a small beast of 30 people, almost 10 years later. And it's a lot of hard work, but it's very, very satisfying. And I have one of the best business partners in the world who said, when I said, "Hey, I'm going to do Eurovision," he was like, "Go for it. Take whatever you need. This is awesome." It did also help that he was a big Eurovision fan. So sleep is not really something that happens a lot, but it happens frequently. And with naps, I think I get in my hours.
What are the other occupations of the band members?
Simone works in a music store. Alex he does graphic design, and he also plays gigs on the weekend with our drummer Ash, who's also a graphic designer. He was actually a graphic design lecturer. And Scott, the other guitarist, is a guitar teacher. So they're all very much creative arts, music related. I think I'm the odd one out that just has gone a vastly different profession on the other side, which I think is good to a degree, because you get to experience something quite remarkably different to being in that scene 24/7. But at the same time, you know, I kind of sometimes go, well, that's your thing. You do your thing, whether it be graphics or whether it be music. You're in this scene. You're living and breathing music all day. And I think that's also amazingly refreshing, because when you breathe music 24 hours a day, you come up with some pretty cool stuff. Whereas I need to switch that music brain off once in a while and get onto the left side of the brain, the law brain.
What do you think are the biggest misconceptions people probably have about your profession? Especially coming to say from a music fan's side, like, oh, you're a lawyer too. Like, how's that possible? Like, you know, because some people have very negative attitudes towards lawyers too.
They do. Yeah. And that's a sad thing, because lawyers do a lot of really good work. So let's talk about lawyers and misconceptions. I think people always go, oh, you're going to charge me for this. You're going to charge me for that. And you know what? We don't charge in 6-minute intervals. We're not greedy. Greedy lawyers. Some are, a lot are, but in a lot of professions there are. We do so much pro bono work, we do so much free work, and it's expected of us. You don't see financial advisors and other professions having an expectation from the industry to go and do pro bono work. You know, that's just not a thing. Why is that a thing with lawyers? So I think the misconceptions are lawyers are going to rip me off, they're going to charge me for every phone call. And it's just not true. Like, it really is. Yes, there are some that do that, but I kind of feel like when I try to shatter that misconception, people expect it anyway. So I sometimes think maybe I should just charge you for the phone call, because you expect it anyway, right? You just expect me to rip you off. So, Matt, why should I shatter your stereotype? You know, I could rip you off. Hey, I'll get rich out of it too. It's amazing. And you'll maintain your stereotype.
Yeah, it is. I don't think people do know that you have the same name as a guitarist from Hoobastank and an NPR host. And I didn't know about the NPR host, and I did find the interview where you guys all spoke together. It's like
three. How Daniel good is Eskrins. It? It's so
that's,
good.
That's crazy. Were you kind of freaked out by that? Like, oh my God.
No. In fact, I think we're finding more Daniel Estrins. Like, Daniel Estrin writes me an email saying, firstly, Daniel Estrin from Hoobastank is always like, man, check this out. You know, someone get all these messages in my DMs. Someone's like, oh, I really liked your outfit on Eurovision. You know, where can I make? I want to get it made for my prom. And the guy's like, wrong Daniel Estrin, dude. Stuff like that. And then the other Daniel Estrin just recently sent me like another Daniel Estrin, who's like some other mixing engineer somewhere. I'm like, what is happening? It's just, at one stage, we're going to have a convention. We're going to get together and start a band. It's going to be called Daniel's Estrin. It's going to be great. And we just have to make it happen.